Hey, buddy, Jimmy Alcoholic. Welcome back from your group. I hope you hope your group's being productive. Well, that doesn't even sound right. I just hope you're having a nice time in your groups. You know, I enjoy our group because they're not smoking. I know that's blasphemy. You know, when you do these things, or any of you guys, you know, you have an idea of what you want to talk about, and that gets diverted real quick because God has other plans. And so I'm sitting at my table, my group, and, you know, apparently the theme is starting to become relationships and amends and cleaning up the past and seeing the truth. More importantly, seeing the truth about relationships. And, you know, we talk about it all the time. You know, that's what life is. Life is about forming relationships, healing relationships, maintaining relationships. And if I'm being driven by my alcoholism, I'm driven by my resentments, if I'm driven by my greed, my selfishness, self-centeredness, man, I'm going to have a tough time in relationships. You know, but when I was willing to start letting go of some of that stuff and start going through this book and starting to examine and seeing and getting down to the truth, my relationships started to heal. And like I shared in the last session, especially with my old man, the topic I was thinking about for this group was, or this meeting, was the two dirty little secrets, romance and finance in Alcoholics Anonymous. But my mind is being diverted a little bit right now about some other things, so maybe I'll get back to that or bring that into play in this. But I want to, you know, I want to talk about my mother for some reason. I don't know why. Well, I know why. You know, especially after my old man died. You know, my mom was the great enabler. Old school, you know, never worked. You know, that's how it was back then. All the dads worked, all the moms stayed home, raised five of us. Did everything for us. She was the nucleus of the family, you know. And I told you about it. We'd come out of that bedroom, my father would be flying off the handle, and, you know, we'd walk out, you know, what do you want to eat? Did you do your homework? Let's not talk about what your father, you just... That powder keg just went off. Let's not talk about that. So my mother would divert us. And, you know, and my mom, I guess her outlet was exercise. My mom was a Jane Fonda workout freak. I was going to look at Jared and James because they look like the youngest here. I was going to say, you could pull out your phone and Google Jane Fonda was. But she, you know, like my mom had the leotards. My mom was in phenomenal, phenomenal shape. Forever. You know, she'd put that VCR in and exercise her ass off, probably trying to forget about life and everything else. And, you know, when my dad died, you know, my mom was old school. She never drove a car in her life. She lived up in the city where I lived, and then I moved down to the shore. My brothers and sisters moved all over the place, and we bought a condo for my mom, and we moved it down to the Jersey Shore. And, you know, she would walk to the library every day. I mean, she'd read 3, 5, 10 books a week. I mean, that's what she did. I mean, she was smart as a whip, very intellectual, never went to college, but she was just a smart woman. And so, you know, when my dad dies, you know, we get her down there, and, you know, she's doing her deal, and I'm the only one that was on the Jersey Shore, so I look in on my mom all the time. We always take her out. She's involved with everything, with me, my kids, you know, all that stuff. And her mind started to slip, and when my mom turned 90 years old, the doctor came to us and said, your mom needs a knee replacement. And we're like, you're out of your mind. She's 90 years old. He goes, your mom's in better shape than her 5 kids put together. She needs a knee replacement. And so my mom gets a knee replaced at 90. Now, I've had 3 knee replacements, and I'm not a drug addict. Well, I like to claim I'm not a drug addict, but I had to take pain pills. My mom never took a pain pill after knee replacement. And if you had a joint replaced, you know that's a tough deal. But they say the older you get, your brain chemistry is different, blah, blah, blah. What we didn't understand, and I don't know if this is factual, but this is what I've been told, that after my mom got put on the anesthesia, her mind really slipped. You know, the dementia really kicked in. And so my mom was losing her mind, 90 years old. I remember sitting in the kitchen, my wife and my wife and my mother were having lunch, and my mom looks at me, she says, where were you? Where were you? I'm like, what are you talking about? And she looked at me, she said, I walked the streets for 2 years looking for you. where were you? And my mind said, I gotta like justify that, right? I made amends to it like 26 years earlier, but now I gotta come back to this again. And the minute I was about to say something, my mom didn't even know who I was. Right out the window. Right? And she just sat there like, who are you? You know, basically. And so the dementia was really bad, really bad. You know, she was living by herself. I was back and forth, back and forth. Eventually we had to get somebody to come in. That got really expensive. And so, you know, one day, I wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning and my son is standing over me. Like, he goes, I've been trying to call you. So what are you doing in the house? I mean, what's the matter? And he goes, the cops called my ex-wife. My mom was walking around the streets at 3 o'clock in the morning in her town with a pocketbook filled with $5,000 in cash. And there was only one phone number in her pocketbook, and that was my ex-wife. And when the cops found her, my mom had no clue who she was, where she lived, any of that stuff. And they called my ex-wife. She called my son. My son came to me, and, you know, then got the ball rolling. We had to start doing something. So I got my brothers and sisters together. Really, my sister took charge. My sister was a big shot. She ran the biggest cancer hospital in New York City called Memorial Sloan Kettering. She was the executive vice president of that hospital and the administrator. So she knew all the ropes and what we needed to do in order to get my mother to a safe place. We put her into assisted living for memory care, and then COVID hit. I just had my third knee replacement coming out of physical therapy, and we couldn't see my mom for years, as some of you guys probably know that. Everything's locked down. You can't, you know, if you want to go see him, it's like looking at a pet, and it's like looking at somebody in a zoo through a glass window. You wave and you keep going. I'm coming out of physical therapy, and a hospice nurse calls me and says, she's going to go. You need to get here. And so the assisted living is a couple of miles away. I drive over there. And at that time, if you guys remember, you had to take the COVID test before you saw someone. You had to put the PPE on. It was like a hazmat suit, you know. And I'm about to go see my mother. Now, I don't know if I'm delusional. I don't know. My sisters are hitting me up. FaceTime mommy. We haven't seen her, blah, blah, blah. And I think I'm walking in on the 60-year-old version of my mother, Jack LaLanne's workout freak, right? I don't know why I'm thinking that way. I have no clue what I'm about to walk into. And the hospice nurse grabs me. She goes, before you walk in, I want to let you know, your mom can't open her eyes and she can't talk, but she could hear you. And the minute she pulled that curtain open, what was laying in that bed was about an 85-pound skeleton. My mother. And then I had my moment. The moment I've been hearing from a lot of AA meetings. The evidence of what goes on with the power of God in your life. Does God really hear our prayers? Does God really hear our prayers? That's the question. I've been saying the prayer of St. Francis for probably over 35 years now, every day. And yeah, a lot of times it's in this little book. A lot of times I'll just read its words, just words, you know. I had a good friend, Don Major. Maybe some of you guys heard of him out of Louisville, Kentucky. He always talked about, in his talk, about being able to love, comfort, and understand the real symbolization of prayer of St. Francis. Can I love, comfort, and understand? And I remember walking in and looking at my mother, and I couldn't believe what I was seeing. And like, there was no way in hell I would FaceTime that. My sisters would have been too traumatic to see that. And I sit down and I grab my mother's hand and I said, Mom, it's me, Jimmy. And her chest explodes with oxygen. Her son has come home. And I have my moment. I have my moment with my mother. It's time to go. Time to be with Dad. Time to be with Louis, my father's name. You know, it's just so powerful to love, comfort, and understand. And isn't that what we're doing here when that newcomer walks through that door? Or isn't that what we're supposed to do when that newcomer walks through that door? We don't shoot our wounded, right? But can I love, comfort, and understand that guy is just me? That's me walking in the door 38 years ago. As a wounded deer, that young girl that just walked into my home group. Can I do that with all my relationships, to love, comfort, and understand? Took a long time for me to learn that. Took a long time for me to learn that. Because I make everything about me. I'm selfish and self-centered to the core. I even hate saying that. But the truth of the matter is I'm selfish and I'm self-centered to the core. And a lot of times I think just about me, what my needs are, needs to be met. So this was a moment of, that I'll never forget. I walked out of that place and an hour later, my mother died. You know, and I'm so grateful to hear your stories. I'm so grateful to hear what we sat at the table. I'm so grateful to hear like how you walk through difficulties in your life. Because if you're here just not to drink, guess what? I think you're shortchanging yourself. Right? It's great that we're not drinking, obviously. It's great we're not taking drugs anymore, obviously. But that's just a symptom to my problem. My problem's me. And I had to start seeing that on a level that I've never seen before. So the evidence is all around us. Am I awake? Because a lot of us sleepwalk throughout sobriety. Can I wake up to the fact that I am not here? I think I'm here. I justify I'm here. Well, I'll tell you, I go to 6 meetings a week. I sponsor half a dozen guys in New Jersey. You know, I make coffee. I set up that. All delusional. Yeah, I'm active. But am I awake to my sobriety? You know, I'm falling asleep sometimes. And I think that's what happens in a lot of relationships. I take for granted the miracle of recovery sometimes. Right? Bill talks about in step 12, in the 12 and 12, he talks about this priceless gift. The question I always ask everyone is, what are you doing with your gift? Are you hoarding it or are you giving it away for fun and for free? And I think that's the key, you know. So that was just something that was on my mind as I sat in a round table over there about, you know, this relationship with my mother, my relationship with my brothers and sisters. I mean, my family lives all over the country. I got a brother in San Diego. I got a brother in Boston. I got a sister in New York, sister down here in Sarasota, you know, and that had to be a lot of healing and a lot of, in my family. We were fucked up and we needed to get down. I was 17 years old. I finally had the hottest girl in high school. And man, I went to my first concert ever. Peter Frampton and the James Gang. For you old-timers. Peter Frampton, that Frampton Comes Alive was just about to come out. And for you guys from the New York area, Walman Ring in Central Park used to have concerts called the Schaefer Series. Schaefer, good old beer, right? And we used to go to those concerts. And man, I'm with this girl and the James Gang. The 17-year-old guitar player for the James Gang was Joe Walsh. He played with the Eagles and, you know, probably a lot of stuff about him too, right? And I remember coming back to my house that night with my hot girlfriend and I blacked out. And next thing I know, I find out that my brother's banging my hot girlfriend. And I wanted to kill my fucking brother. I wanted to kill. I didn't talk to him for years. Years. Decades. Decades. I carried such hatred and resentment towards him. 2 years ago, I got invited to speak at the San Diego Roundup, and I'm out there, and my brother lives in San Diego. My wife goes, "You're going to call your brother?" And I'm like, "No, fuck him. Excuse my French. I don't curse from the podium, but man, I was angry still." I talked to my sponsor about it. He goes, "Why don't you just call your brother? Go to lunch, breakfast. You don't have to make it a big deal. Just, why don't you just reach out to him. He's gone through some health issues. Just reach out to him." So I call my brother up. I said, "Hey, I'm in San Diego. You were shocked here. I go, do you want to go for breakfast?" And he came to the hotel and got me. And what I saw was a frail old guy. It wasn't the guy that I was giving all the power to. It's just a frail old guy that's like 74 years old now. You know? And God healed us that day. Over eggs and bacon in a diner in San Diego, California. We talked about things and I didn't have to bring up something from 50 something years ago, but you know what? We just healed that day. And now our contact has been pretty good. You know, not great. Doesn't have to be great. I'm closer to guys in AA than I am my family. I hear that all the time. You know, I trust you guys more than I trust my brothers. Right. So, you know, that's the kind of, relationships that we have to get past, and I had to get past that. So I told you before earlier that when those cops came to me with my kids 8 and 5 years old, the reason why they came to me is because I'm in this relationship with this girl that I cheated on my wife with, a 10-year sobriety, You know, she showed me a little tension. She touched my leg, attraction. And I'm like, hook, line, and sinker. I fall for this girl. We start this torrid sexual romance. You know, she's running from her problems. I'm definitely running from my problems. But we don't want to, like, talk about that stuff. We just think we're, you know, in AA love, you know. I mean, ridiculous. But, you know, she's, you know, about 3 years I'm with her. You know, I'm living a double life in Alcoholics Anonymous. Fifth Step talks about that all the time. You know, I'm doing things over there because I don't want you guys to see what I'm doing over here. So I'm living this double life. I'm lying to everyone. I'm dishonest to my sponsor, you know. And at 10 years, like I said, or 13 years, like I said, you know, I almost pick up a drink, you know. And so this woman, why the sheriff's in there, because I just had back surgery. I had 5 discs taken out of my lower back, old school, put a cinder block in my back, sewed me up, and I'm walking on a walker in AA for about 3 years with a walker. You would have thought I was 100 years old. I had both knees replaced and back surgery, all like within an 8-month period. I was a mess physically. And I'm in her garage one day, and she's saying something to me, and it escalates into it, and I threaten to break her neck or something of that nature, and she calls the cops on me. And I just take off, and all of a sudden the cops show up at my house that night, or my mother's house, because that's where most 40-year-old men go, to back to mommy's house. And basically it was a restraining order she has against me, right? Because she feels threatened by me. And I'm pissed. I'm angry. And, you know, what happens is, you know, I have to go to court on this restraining order. I haven't been in court in so many years, I don't even know what to do. You know, basically it's ridiculous. And I'm sitting in the court, in a courtroom, outside the courtroom, and I see her walk in, and she's with a guy with a suit on. And I'm like, holy shit, she brought a lawyer. I thought she was just trying to teach me a lesson with my anger. You know, let's bring it to the edge, and then I'll, you know, forgive you for being a jerk. But no, she was full on, balls on me. And we go into the courtroom, and, you know, this lawyer, she rips me apart. The judge, the lawyer's ripping me apart. And I'm just sitting there, like, in total freaking, like, meltdown mode. I want to just pull out a gun and shoot everyone right now. I feel so attacked. Judge stands up. I'll never forget it. Like, I'm standing right here, just like you, just a little jab, and it's right there. I'm standing there. He pulls out a New Jersey meeting book, and I could still see, I still have PTSD from red Sharpies. He has a red Sharpie in his hand, and he's circling meetings that I'm banned from. Who the hell gets banned from AA meetings? I do. That's who. Because this woman was a member of AA, and I'm like, I couldn't believe it. Fast forward. I meet my wife. Well, I don't meet my wife. My wife of today. I go through a divorce. That's a whole other story in itself. You know, I go through a divorce with my first wife. I know this girl. We become friends. My wife today, back then, she was a member of the World Trade Center group. It was a meeting every day in the World Trade Center, World Trade Center on the 7th floor. And on 9/11, when the towers came down, she lost a lot of members in her home group. You know, so it was a really, she used to invite guys like us, come over there, do a 15-minute pitch. So you do the pitch and became a cup of coffee, became lunch, became a proposal. We'll be married 21 years next Wednesday. And so I'm with her. We're just going out, and we go to a meeting, and this girl walks in with her new boyfriend. Now, this is years later, and she causes such a scene in this meeting. She says, he's going to kill me. She's, like, going off on me, and thank God my girlfriend, now wife, was with me. She goes, let's go. We don't need to be here. And I went to a police station right in town, and I told the cops what happened. They said, no, we just asked you to leave that cop. You know, you're not in restraining, you're not in violation of your restraining order, blah, blah, blah. And I am pissed off, angry. I got such resentments against this woman. So this is when I meet Peter Marinelli. And we're going through the process of the book. We're starting to peel back the onion a little bit deeper because, you know, we have to peel the onion back. I can't live on an inventory I did 5 years ago because, you know, like the old saying, you know, did you eat a meal last week? Yeah. Well, are you going to eat one today? Because that meal's not going to keep you full. So I need to constantly be looking at me, not in a self-absorbing way, but in a reflective, contemplative way that we do through the process of the recovery. Right? I got to shine a light on me. Right? I got to see where I'm falling short. And so as I go through the steps with Peter, we start to look at a lot of things, and I write inventory. I got to write inventory on this woman, and I got a long list of things, right? But here's the problem. The inventory process asked me to be honest and thorough, or thorough and honest. come to find out, it's really hard to be honest when you got to be right. I got to be right on this. Why? Because I couldn't see the truth about how I was acting in this relationship. I couldn't see how I became dependent, or maybe that's a nice word, or a therapy word, dependent. I was using this woman for sex. I was using this woman for money. I was using this woman for, like, she was like a service dog to me, emotional support. I was using her because I'm such a piece of crap for the things I did to my children and my ex-wife that I would go into a relationship at 10 years sober and blow up my family just because I wanted to have some sexual relationship and to live this life. I didn't even want to, like, admit that. And I was ashamed of myself. I was regretful. I was remorseful. You name it, right? And so I'm writing this inventory, and yeah, it's hard to be right when you got to be honest, you know, and I got to be honest and how I'm showing up. You know, if you guys are familiar, you're that first column, second column, you know, I'm camping out in column three, you know, the ego loves to live in column three. It affects me this way, right? The ego gets free room and free board in that third column. This is where all the judgments I have are. I don't want to go in that column four. If you're familiar with the inventory, I don't want to look at my side. I don't want to look at my mistakes, my wrongdoings, or any of that stuff. I just want to blame her, because God forbid you find out. That's part of the double life we live in AA. I don't want anyone to know about what I'm doing, but I want to keep doing what I'm doing. And what happens eventually is, you know, I write this inventory, I start to see some truth about Jimmy. We realize that perhaps the people that have wronged us are spiritually sick as well. I started to look at this thing from a different angle. That everything I was angry about, I do. Everything I see in myself or in her, I do. I started to see that I'm just as sick as this woman. And she had to protect herself from an animal like me. And yeah, we get that sick man pray, you know, in that inventory process, you know. Pray for the person. How could I be helpful? God, take away my anger. There's a story in back of the book on page 551 by Gwen Lohr. It's called Freedom from Bondage. And there's a story about there how she had to get rid of resentment. You know, she was in a hospital setting one day, picked up a book or a magazine, said resentment across the top. And in that article, it said, if you want to be free of resentment, start praying for that person. Start praying for everything that you want in your life to have, for them to have in their life. And I read that article. I said, you know, and I know a lot of people say, that's bullshit. That's not going to work. What do I have to lose? The power of God runs deep. We know that. So why am I going to deny the power of God when I can read? Just let's try it. This woman in the book does it for 2 weeks. I did it for 2 weeks. I did it for 2 months. About 4 months later, I'm waking up every day and I'm praying for this woman that she gets in her life what I want in my life: sobriety, good health, all the attributes that are good for us, all of us. And I wake up on one day out of the clear blue, didn't expect it. The resentment was lifted. I started to see the truth. I was confronted with the truth that I couldn't deny anymore. And I became willing in that moment that I have to make amends to this woman. Now, here's the problem. This is years later. And I'm still holding on to resentment from that long ago against this woman. But this woman, who I was in an affair with, was 28 years sober, and she moved to Dallas, Texas. She hung herself. She committed suicide in Dallas, Texas. How am I going to make amends to that? Yeah, we could write a letter and go to a gravesite and read to the stone. That's nice. That works, I guess. Right? But how am I really going to clear this? How am I really going to get free of this, right? 2 years ago, you guys had Cliff Gooding here. Cliff invited me down to his conference. I did his retreat last January. And I'm telling the same story I'm telling you guys right now. I tried to find this woman for years. I couldn't find her. I would Google her name. It would just show her professional career, all this other stuff. Couldn't find her. And one day, I don't know why she popped in my mind. I said, why don't I just Google her name one more time? And I did. And a website comes up called Find a Grave. Never saw it. Never heard about it. Nothing. And all you got to do is put the person's name in. It gives you not only the person's full name, not only where they're buried, not only the block number, not only what road to walk down to find the gravesite, he gives you everything about where this person is. And I'm like looking at this like, no freaking way. She's buried in Clarion, Iowa, wherever the hell that is. So I'm telling this story. And I'm in Oklahoma. I'll be in Oklahoma next week. And there's a bunch of dudes from Iowa there. And I'm telling this story, and a guy walks up to me and goes, hey, would you like to do a conference in Iowa? I said, where? He goes, Davenport, I forget what it is. Cedar Rapids, I think. I said, Cedar Rapids? Where? I'm like, gee, like I need to look at a map. I don't even know where Iowa is. I know it's out there somewhere. And so I say to the guy, hey, did you ever hear of Clarion, Iowa? He goes, yeah, that's about 20 minutes down the road from where you're going to be. Is it odd or is it God, as they say? So next year, as I'm in Iowa, I guess I'm going to be writing a letter and going to make amends on this to this woman. And hopefully God heals that. Because that's my only outstanding amends that I'm sitting here with and I'm aware of right now. You know, that wife I walked out on, man, I really effed her up big time. I leveled her. She didn't even see what was coming. Right? How do you make amends to that? How do you make amends to an 8-year-old and a 5-year-old who walk out on? The greatest thing that ever happened to me was getting in that accident on December 6, 1999. You know, I was an every other weekend dad and a Wednesday night dad. Right? But getting in that accident, it gave me the ability to be at everything that my children did. My son was a big sports bot, so was my daughter. She was a big swimmer. My son was a basketball player, football player. But he did every sport through high school. So I had the opportunity, whether they were on the freshman team, the JV team, or the varsity, I went to every game where most guys, most dads couldn't because they worked all day long. So I had the opportunity to do that. And my ex-wife had seen me coming to everything. She'd see how I'd be showing up. And all of a sudden, we're sitting in the stands at my son's football games, and we're sitting together. People in my town thought we were still married. We were divorced 10 years at this point. I had friends in that stadium that, you know, one guy had, the husband had to sit over there and the ex-wife had to sit in that end zone because if they were within 50 yards of each other, it was going to be an explosion. Alcoholics Anonymous, the 12 steps, plus God, started to heal my relationship with my ex-wife. I coached girls basketball. This game was intense, like court, like the court here, door to door, back and forth, back and forth. God grabs me back by the head in one of these games and says, look in the stands. I look in the stands and what do I see? I see my ex-wife sitting with my wife and my mother. And I'm like, I wonder what they're talking about. They weren't talking about me. They were talking about whatever they were talking about. But why I bring that up is because the family disease of alcoholism, I'm not a member of AA, but I know enough about the family disease of alcoholism. My family started to heal. But I had to take the lead on that. I had to show up. You know, I gave her an amends once where she basically said, go screw yourself. I 9 out of 10 times, the unexpected happens. Things started to change. And it took a while. And it wasn't in Jimmy's time. It was in God's time. My job was to show up and to show up and to show up. You know, when my daughter got married, me and my ex-wife, we walked my daughter down the aisle. You know, and today it's such a weird thing. We have a family event. My children have blessed me and themselves with babies. I got a 3-year-old granddaughter, a 1-year-old grandson, and a 4-month-old grandson. And I get to babysit those kids. I'm with the 1-year-old 3 times a day, 9 hours a day. Man, that's a young man sport. Holy shit, am I tired? But I love it, but I'm tired. And now that he's walking, man, it's like, okay, there's just an accident waiting to happen. You know, he's going to clock it. He's going home with a big bump or maybe a cracked skull. But I love it. I just love it. You walk out on an 8-year-old and a 5-year-old, and they're handing you their child. Does God heal? Does God heal? Two words that I have a real problem with are private property. That's a joke. As I said last night, I'm a thief. I'm a crook. I'm just a street urchin that, man, if it wasn't tied down, I would take it, you know? And, You know, I have such problems with finances and money. Money's power. Money, you could buy things. Money, I think you could, the delusion of money where I think if I have enough money, I'll be okay, which is bullshit. We know that. I sponsor guys that are multi-gazillionaires and they pull up in front of my house with their $150,000 Mercedes, the house on the beach, I mean, the nice clothes, and they come in my house and they sit at the kitchen table and they're more hollow than a tree. External conditions doesn't equate to internal conditions at all. I could dress the outside up, but the soul sickness that I suffer from, you know, we all suffer from. Without being treated, guess what? I'm just a nice looking, nice driver, nice guy. Emptiness, really. You know, and so I've always associated money with power because I didn't have money growing up. I was a thief. I was a stealer. I'd do all that stuff, right? And again, under the delusion of alcoholism, because alcoholism doesn't come in a bottle, it comes in my mind. My mind tells me if I just have enough of that, I'll be good to go. I get that, and I'm not good to go. Enough is never enough. So there's always that chase. I'm like a dog chasing its tail, doing all the crap I'm doing. So right from a young age, I'm ripping off places. I'm doing this. We're robbing cars. We're robbing freight trains. That's the way we grew up in the city. It was, you know, this wasn't the moral compass I had. I didn't know any better. I did know better. Who's that? Who am I lying? I did know better. But I'm such a chameleon. I want to be part of rather than separate from. Let me go with these guys, and I'm doing the things we're doing. And, you know, Peter was telling a story once. He was telling about 97 minutes how he used to rob lockers in high school. And it hit me. Holy shit. I've been robbing candy stores when I was a little kid in this old neighborhood that I lived in. You know, you got the old mom and grandma and grandpa, Sicilians coming off the boat. They open up a little store in the town and they're selling sodas and candy and newspapers, stuff like that. We'd go in there and like me buying drinks when I got older, trying to buy your friendships. I was going in those places, robbing soda, robbing candy, going out like the Pied Piper, giving all these kids, trying to buy friendships. I completely forgot that I robbed those places. So I hear this story from Peter. I'm like, holy shit, that never hit any inventory I ever wrote. And he goes, well, you know what to do. I said, I do know what to do. And so I kind of equated what I stole in today's money. And, you know, I had my truck and my home group, I moved down to Jersey Shore, but I knew my home group up in North Jersey just started a soup kitchen, a lunch kitchen for the homeless. Now I've been living on the streets for 2 years almost. I know what it's like to be hungry. And I know what it's like not to have food and nourishment and all that stuff. So I went to Costco and I loaded my truck, probably $1,000. And I don't tell that for a pat on the back. I'm just letting you know what happened. And I load my truck up. I drive up to the city and I pull up. There's a bunch of old ladies who work in the kitchen. And I'm like, I just want to donate this. Why you want, you know, I don't have to say, well, I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And in order to get free, I got to, you know. Here, but I'll tell you what happened. I got in my truck. I don't think my tires hit the road the whole way home. I was floating. Because the amends process is not about relief. It's not about freedom, not about relief or to feel better, even though you do. It's about the intent is to be free. And I was free. I was sober a year. I got two letters from the state. When you get a letter from the state in New Jersey and there's a seal on it, they're not asking you what you're thinking about. I got indicted on two counts of grand theft. I stole $27,881.76 in the 70s, thinking I could outfox a computer when computers started to come out with unemployment. I was cooking the books, as we say, and I got nailed with 1 year sobriety, and I denied it, and I was terrified, and I was afraid, and I didn't tell anyone. My little secret, right? The thing that will kill me. If you think you're walking through that threshold of that doorway with a little secret in your back pocket, you think you're going to be free? Well, I'm here to tell you, no, you're not. And I knew I wasn't, but I was too afraid to talk to anyone about it. 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, 5 years holding on to that secret that I ripped off and stole money, and I'm indicted on these things. And what happened was, you know, I had to face the music, and that's when I did my first inventory with this guy, Bill Grace, from St. Paul, Minnesota. And I put it down. I was so afraid to write about it. And then he, you know, in that fifth step, he talked about the stuff he did. And not that it loosened the blow, let's say that. And I became willing to clean that up. So I got in touch with the judge. I'm a lawyer, blah, blah, blah. And I had to go to court. And my lawyer said, it'd be really nice to get a bunch of AA guys to write nice letters about what you're doing and how you're trying to help people. It's only going to help your case. So I talked to my ex-wife, and we were still married at the time, and I told her what happened. She freaked. And I said, there's a good chance I'm going back to jail on this one. I don't know what the time frame is. I don't know any of that stuff. But I got to make this right. I can't live with myself, and I can't live with this hanging over my head, because I will drink again. I know that better than anyone. That was one thing I very became aware of. Holding on to secrets, I am going to drink again. I can't. I'm not real good at holding on to secrets. And so I go to the courtroom, and, you know, I got a couple of AA guys. There's a guy at the end, you know, he has a letter. Jimmy makes good coffee on Tuesday. I'm like, what's he talking about, you know? And what I couldn't see is what God was going to do for me that day. The judge stood up, and I'm waiting to get hammered. And he goes, it would be a real shame after hearing all these gentlemen, and there was a couple of ladies, hearing what you're doing in your life and trying to help others, that it would be a real shame to put you in jail. So I'm going to put you on probation for 5 years. You're paying back the 27 and change, but we have a thing in New Jersey called the interest. So you're going to pay that back on top. It came out to about $34,000. I started to cry. Because I knew I was going to be free, because I knew I could pay that money back, because I'm a hard worker. Where did I learn how to be a hard worker? My old man. My old man taught me how to be a hard worker. I didn't know that then. I know it today. And within 2 years, I paid that all back. $34,000. I worked my ass off. Overtime, whenever I could do it, whatever the case may be. And, you know, again, how many guys do I hear and talk to? IRS problems, tax problems, this problem, that problem, money problem. Sandy Beach, who maybe a lot of you guys have heard before, said one of the most profound things I ever heard at a retreat I do in Jersey. Him and my sponsor, Bob Bizance, were doing a big book retreat weekend, and they were talking about money. And Sandy said, the problem with money is none of us read the warning label. Here we go. He said, look at the back of a dollar bill. What's it say? In God we trust. And that was like the most profound thing I ever heard. I've never trusted God with money. I've never brought God into my money, right? I've hoarded my money. I've held on to my money. I've used money to buy happiness, let's just say, to buy freedom. And the truth of the matter is, man, I'm just driven by a lot of old ideas. I'm driven by a lot of old ideas, which do come from my father, which do come from my mother, which do come from people in my life, that if I have enough of this, I'll be okay. You know, real men don't have debt by the time they're 50. Well, at 50 years old, I had a lot of debt. You know, real men know how to save money. I don't know how to save money. I pay Peter to pay Paul. Every time I open up my mailbox, it's financial fear right out of the gate. Right? I pull the bills out. You know, I borrow money from Peter to pay that. I take a credit card to pay that. I borrow money off guys I shouldn't be borrowing money off to pay that. There's a sense of relief. There's a sense of ease and comfort until 30 days later when those bills come in again. I don't know how to be sober with my money. I read a book many years ago. Somebody handed it to me. Now I can't remember it. But it's all about how to live a sober life when it comes to money. And I know money is a problem for a lot of us. Materialism, a problem for a lot of us. You know, we're inundated day in and day out on the TV. We're watching a football game, and it's like, if you don't drive this car, you're a piece of shit. You know, if you don't smell like that, you're a piece of shit. If you don't wear these clothes, we get inundated with materialism that, guess what? If you don't have this, you're not good enough. We hear that. And just like a little kid being told, you're not enough. We hear that. And all of a sudden, I'm buying things that I don't need, can't afford, because I think that's the answer to this internal problem called alcoholism. And I suffer, and I suffer, and I suffer. So the question is always, am I bringing God into my money? Am I bringing God into my relationships? Am I willing to live on terms other than my own? Right? Because real freedom, the real freedom we're talking about in here, is about understanding the power of God and how God works in our lives. The only way I'm going to learn that is by talking to you guys. You know, the only way I'm going to learn that is by going through this shit and dealing with it and learning that, you know what? Self-sufficiency never works. Self-reliance never works. You know, making that decision in the third step you know, that I'm going to stop playing God, right? I mean, I read that book right here, man. I can't control. Life is uncontrollable. But I'll tell you what else he writes in here, though, and I'll end on this. The more clearly you realize lack of control, the more powerless you discover to be. The more powerless you discover yourself to be, the more natural it is for you to be surrendered to God. The more surrendered to God you become, the less you struggle against the natural flow of life. The less you struggle against the flow of life, the freer you become. Radical powerlessness is radical freedom, liberating you from the need to control the ocean of life and freeing you to learn how to best to navigate it. Let go and let God. How the hell do you do that? Just let go and let God. That's how you do that. That's all I have. Thank you.